My Lai was a real turning point, as perhaps it was for many Americans, in relationship to our individual and collective conscience.
The My Lai massacre was an extreme event. We know in Iraq and in Afghanistan there have been occasional situations where civilians have been deliberately murdered, but it's on a much smaller scale.
I have psychological scars I'll carry with me to the grave. You can't erase what happened and things you did. You can't go back and rectify a past situation.
March the 16th, 1968. Horror and barbarism swept through the village of My Lai in Vietnam. Just a single day, but with consequences that still reverberate 40 years later in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The first time the Americans came, the children followed them. They gave the children sweets to eat, then they smiled and left. The second time they came, we poured them water to drink. The third time, they killed everyone. Killed everybody, destroyed everything. Nothing was left.
I was personally responsible for killing between 20 and 25 people. To cutting their throats, to scalping them, cutting off their hands, and cutting out their tongue. I just lost all sense of direction, of purpose. I just started killing any kind of way I could kill.
The rape and murder by American soldiers of 504 Vietnamese civilians in My Lai and the subsequent cover-up is one of the darkest episodes in U.S. military history. In this program, we piece together the events of March the 16th, 1968, through archive and interviews. But you'll also hear the very voices of the soldiers who did the killing. You'll listen to never-before-broadcast recordings made during the U.S. military's investigation into that massacre.
I got a letter from LBJ. It said, this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very queer, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam.
Vietnam was America's longest war, a hot war extension of the Cold War, an attempt to stop the communists from toppling one country after another in Southeast Asia. The United States fought there from the early 1960s until 1975. I was studying, dropped out, and went to Vietnam as a freelance photographer in 1966, convinced the war would blow over before I could finish college.
Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying.
In all, I spent 2.5 years covering the Vietnam War. Today, again, I'm a military journalist, the senior managing editor at Army Times, an independent publishing company. In the lead up to the My Lai massacre in 1968, the journalist and academic Jonathan Schell was also in Vietnam. He reported from Quang Nai Province, where the village of My Lai was located.
The atmosphere was one that for some years had been to really make war on the Vietnamese people. And the result had been this incredible devastation, really looking like Japan or Germany after the Second World War. It wasn't just a matter of a village here or a village there that had been destroyed. Another very, very important aspect of all of this is that great areas of the province had been declared on the ground as being free fire zones. What that meant was that there was just a ceaseless barrage of artillery fire going into those regions. Everybody and everything that moved was considered to be the enemy. So the idea that you could kill civilians was hardly something original or novel. And in fact, I personally witnessed just village after village being ground up in ground operations that were accompanied by airstrikes with napalm, phosphorus, 750-pound bombs, and 20-millimeter cannon fire from the planes.
This is the main South Vietnamese language radio station of Saigon. And right now some of the Viet Cong are inside occupying the station. We understand they're not broadcasting on the air, but they do have control of the station. South Vietnamese troops outside, waiting for some tear gas to arrive, which they're going to use. There's a Viet Cong machine gun in there, about 100 yards away. They're trying to get it with gunships, in the case the men should try to flee into the street.
Early on January the 31st, 1968, at the start of Tet, the Lunar New Year, more than 80,000 North Vietnamese Army and Viet Cong guerrillas, the VC, attacked every important city and military base in South Vietnam. It became known as the Tet Offensive. It was a disaster for the North Vietnamese. Half their forces were killed. But it also shocked Americans because President Lyndon Johnson and the military had led us to believe the U.S. was winning the war. If that was the case, Americans wondered, how could the enemy stage such large-scale attacks? By 1968, there were nearly 500,000 U.S. troops in South Vietnam, and more were being hurriedly drafted, enlisted, and trained.
My name is Frederick Widmer. I'm currently 60 years old. I enlisted in the Army when I was 19. I'm originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And at the time I went into the service, I had finished high school, attended some college, and was working construction. I came from an average middle-class American family. At that point in time, it was either enlist or be drafted, because the draft was after myself and my friends, and a lot of us did wind up in Vietnam.
Men like Fred Widmer were dropped into this desperate situation. He and his company arrived in the My Lai area in late January. They'd trained in Hawaii for about 9 months, had their training cut short by a month, and then shipped to Vietnam. Then their in-country training was also cut short, from 4 weeks to just 1 week. Widmer joined the newly created Task Force Barker, formed from three companies, Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie. Task Force Barker carried out two high-profile operations in February 1968, claiming to have killed 155 Viet Cong, but they captured only six weapons. The fact is that most of the men sent into battle in My Lai were inexperienced and few had seen combat. They were not the battle-weary, shell-shocked troops whose beastly behavior might be explained by the traumas they'd suffered.
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three, what are we fighting for?
First thing I realized when I got to Vietnam, the most important thing is body count. That's what this whole war is about.
Open up the pearly gates.
Ron Haberle is today in his late 60s. He studied photography at University in Ohio, was drafted as a soldier to Vietnam, and joined a public information office there as an Army photographer. It would be his photos that would later show the world what awful things happened in My Lai. Like Fred Widmer, Ron Haberle felt unprepared for the operation.
It was not a conventional war where the enemy is right in front of you and you can easily identify them. It was just guerrilla warfare, and I don't think we were very well trained in how to fight a guerrilla warfare. Plus, we also did not understand the culture of the environment of the people. You know, the history of the people, or even a little bit about their language, what to expect. It's just like we were put into the country, and we had to try to figure this out for ourselves.
From what we were told, we were going to be going down into the My Lai area, which we had been in many times before, and it was an area which was well noted for snipers and booby traps. And as you gradually lost people from the company, and you have to remember, we were together for almost a year, and we had lost people to mines, snipers, booby traps. The minefield was an instance where we had seven killed and, 17 wounded in the span of about 15 minutes. Before we went into My Lai, we looked at it as a way of getting revenge for everybody that we had lost. Before going down there, we were told that anybody down there would be considered VC or VC sympathizers, and as such would be dealt with as such, and we were on a search and destroy mission, and that everything from the housing, food, people were to be destroyed, because that's what a search and destroy mission was.
Americans called the My Lai area Pinkville, as it had been pink in their military maps. It had a reputation for harboring Viet Cong and VC sympathizers and had already seen some U.S. and South Vietnamese activity. But the villages were still relatively intact. It was a beautiful area, a grouping of several hamlets, tropical fertile fields set around thatched bamboo huts, hooches to the GIs. Close by to the east, the white powder beaches of the South China Sea, home to thriving fishing communities. That morning, the villagers were going about their normal chores. March the 16th, 1968, was clear, warm, and dry. The operation lasted about 4 hours. It began around 7:30 in the morning. Amazingly, their early activity that day was tape-recorded back at the base. That's what you hear now. The tapes were going to be used for Army training purposes. These tapes actually ended up later as evidence in the Army's inquiry into My Lai.
46, you say it seems to be hot. Did you receive fire when you first went in, over?
Negative reported fire as many of the slicks, so.
Did you receive fire, he asked. The chopper pilot answered, negative reported fire from any of the slicks. Slicks were the Huey transport choppers. The attacks on the village started a few minutes before 8 a.m. Charlie Company moved in first to My Lai, followed by Bravo Company to their objective, the fishing village of My Kay, 3 kilometers to the east. About 190 men in total. That day, what Ron Haberly saw and the photographs he took are beyond harrowing.
And so the helicopters put down, and we jumped out, and we heard a lot of firing. And we were on the ground for maybe about a minute, and then still hear a lot of firing going. I thought, holy cow, this is really a hot zone. But after, you know, a couple minutes later, we realized we were not being fired at. There was no, you know, outgoing fire. So we all stood up and started advancing toward a road. And I could see some people on the road kind of, you know, running, moving, and Americans just, you know, opened up on these people and just indiscriminately, you know, just fired at them. They were just, you know, women and some children that were shot, and just kind of, you know, freaked me out a little bit. I couldn't, you know, understand really what was going on. I couldn't comprehend the scene at that time. So after that, we started moving into the village, and when I walked into the village, I mean, it was just pretty carnage in the village. Just unreal scenes happening. I mean, the hooches were burning. There was people, dead people laying in some of the hooches. There was people, you know, on the trail. I think the weirdest thing was some of the soldiers were jumping on some of the animals, the water buffaloes, with their bayonets trying to stab them. And just a complete, you know, freak-out scene. But still, to this day, I still can't really figure it out.
Fred Widmer of Charlie Company wasn't observing the scene. He was taking part.
I was walking down the trail, and a young boy came around the corner. He's probably about 8 years old, and he had half of his arm, one arm blown off, and his guts were hanging out. Somebody had previously shot him, and he survived, and I shot and killed him. You could say my justification was it was a mercy killing because I knew he would not get any treatment or be taken out of that situation due to the mission that we were on.
On the spot, watching Fred Widmer and the boy, was Ron Haberly.
I happened to notice an American soldier kneeling down beside me, raised his rifle, and shot this kid. And I'll never forget looking through the viewfinder of this kid being flipped up in the air, another shot, and the kid just fell on the pile of bodies. The soldier looked up. I looked at him, and I said, why? He just looked at me. We were about, I say, 2 inches from each other's face, and he just turned and walked away.
There were very few survivors of the massacre. In 1988, some of them were interviewed for the film 4 Hours in My Lai, made for Yorkshire Television by Michael Bilton and Kevin Sim. Chung T. Lay was one of the villagers who survived.
They were firing their guns over there. They blasted away and people were dying. Oh, it's so horrible. I pushed my son into the paddy field and lay on top of him. I told him, don't cry. The Americans have shot everyone. Don't cry and see if we can survive. For a while, I didn't hear any noise. I was alive because there were corpses on top of me. I lifted my head and saw Americans pointing here and there incessantly. Those who were still alive were shot again and again. Then there was no more.
to stem the tide, a tide which never saw the seas. It flows through jungles around the trees. Some say it's yellow, some say red. It will not matter when we're dead.
4 hours later, by the time Task Force Barker left, they'd sustained one death and eight injuries. Three Viet Cong had been killed. Any others had fled before the operation. But 504 villagers were murdered, many burned and mutilated. Women and young girls were gang-raped, three villages destroyed, cattle slaughtered, crops razed. That isn't the story that came out initially. The operation was touted as a success by the U.S. Army. General Westmoreland, the head of the Army, even sent a congratulatory telegram to the commanding officers, and the newspaper headlines were triumphant. Task Force Barker crushes enemy stronghold. U.S. troops surround Reds, kill 128. Back home in the USA, misgivings about the Vietnam War were growing. Protests had been gathering pace since early 1968.
And as the tear gas canisters began to burst around us, there was no alternative. Over some gardens, along a pavement, coughing and spluttering, we went. I saw a girl tear up the stars and stripes.
In spite of the cover-up, news of the massacre at My Lai gradually came to light, thanks to several factors. Ronald Ridenour, also a GI in Vietnam, but not at My Lai, was having a drink with a friend from Charlie Company. His friend casually told him about the massacre and that they'd been told to cover their asses. Ridenour was shocked and, an aspiring journalist, began his own investigation. On March the 29th, 1969, a whole year after My Lai, Ridenour wrote a detailed and damning letter, which he sent to the new president, Richard Nixon, to General Westmoreland, and to a host of other government officials and lawmakers.
Gentlemen, it was late in April 1968 that I first heard of Pinkville and what allegedly happened there. I received that first report with some skepticism, but in the following months I was to hear similar stories from such a wide variety of people that it became impossible for me to disbelieve that something rather dark and bloody did indeed occur sometime in March 1968 in a village called Pinkville in the Republic of Vietnam.
In addition to this incriminating letter, by the end of 1969, Ron Haberle had published his photographs of the massacre in Life magazine, and the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh had broken the story in the New York Times. The top military brass knew they had to act, and quietly, very quietly, just before the story broke, they began criminal investigations. But it was skillful damage limitation. They focused the blame on only one company, on one My Lai hamlet, and court-martialed only five men. Of those men, only one was convicted, Lieutenant William Calley of Charlie Company. He was accused of murdering 102 villagers, and after a lengthy court-martial, was convicted of 22 murders. In December 1969, the lawyer Jerome Walsh was about to become a key player in uncovering the truth about My Lai.
Is a combination, like a kind of a perfect storm, a combination of disastrous events came together. One was Lieutenant Calley, who was the minimal requirements to be an officer, and he never would have been an officer if it hadn't been for the extreme pressure the Army was on to build up its strength, to get 500,000 men into Vietnam while maintaining 500,000 in Germany, and they had to increase the draft. And so people like Calley became officers. He was the minimum height requirement, 5'4". He was the minimum IQ level, 115. He had the minimum educational requirements, 2 years at a junior college. Then he gets in there as a lieutenant. It was our general conclusion that this was a very unlucky, unfortunate collection of events and people that came together here.
Lieutenant Calley's defense was that he was just following orders. These were his last carefully crafted words of explanation to his court-martial judge.
If I have committed a crime, the only crime that I have committed is in judgment of my values. Apparently, I valued my troops' lives more than I did that of the enemy. When my troops were getting massacred and mauled by an enemy I couldn't see, I couldn't feel, and I couldn't touch, that nobody in the military system ever described as anything other than communism. They didn't give it a race. They didn't give it a sex. They didn't give it an age. They never let me believe it was just a philosophy in a man's mind. And that was my enemy out there. And when it became between me and that enemy, I had to value the lives of my troops. And I feel that is the only crime I have committed.
Public sympathy swung in support of Calley. He was seen as a scapegoat, and President Nixon reduced his sentence substantially. In December 1969, at a White House press conference, Nixon admitted My Lai was a massacre.
What appears was certainly a massacre, and under no circumstances was it justified. One of the goals we are fighting for in Vietnam is to keep the people from South Vietnam from having imposed upon them a government which has atrocity against civilians as one of its policies. And we cannot ever condone or use atrocities against civilians in order to accomplish that goal. As far as this kind of activity is concerned, I believe it is an isolated incident. Certainly within this administration, we are doing everything possible to find out whether it was isolated, and so far our investigation indicates that it was.
By the end of 1969, General Westmoreland had left Vietnam to become Army Chief of Staff. He and Secretary of the Army Stanley Reeser were so concerned about rumors of a cover-up that they ordered an internal inquiry. It became known as the Piers Inquiry. For 3 months, from December 1969 until March 1970, the panel questioned 403 witnesses, under oath and in secret. Everyone from the foot soldiers to the division command. Transcripts were made of every word, and 400 hours were recorded. And it's the extracts from those audio tapes, exclusive to our program, that you'll hear tonight for the first time. These recordings lay undiscovered until last year, when they were tracked down by British journalist Selina Dunlop in the National Archives just outside Washington.
You were requested that you not either directly or indirectly or through any other means discuss the My Lai incident, the investigation of the My Lai incident, or the investigation which we are conducting with others.
The core team consisted of General William Piers, his deputy, retired Colonel Bland West, two civilian lawyers, and other senior military figures. No expense was spared, and no stone was left unturned. Jerome Walsh, talking today, was one of the two lawyers appointed by General Piers.
They turned over to the inquiry a number of rooms in the basement of the Pentagon that had been set up, originally, I was told, as a crisis room for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In other words, if some, I don't know whether atomic crisis or some big conflagration occurred, you know, when the Army wants to do something and has carte blanche to do it, they can pull in a lot of resources. And General Piers was given that kind of authority to just get whatever he wanted.
But what about General Piers himself? Who was the man given this enormous task? Piers was 55 at the time of the inquiry. He'd served in the U.S. Army for 32 years in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
He had a broken nose from his football days. He smoked big cigars. He liked a couple of martinis before dinner. He was had a good sense of humor. He had no pretense to him, and he was loved by ordinary soldiers.
At the very beginning of the inquiry, General Piers set out their aims.
First, the adequacy of prior investigations and inquiries into and the subsequent reviews and reports within the chain of command of what is now commonly referred to as the My Lai incident of 16 March 19.
One of the first to testify was former GI Ron Ridenour, who'd helped trigger the inquiry. He'd not been at My Lai, but he'd written the letter about the massacre to just about everyone in the U.S. government who mattered.
Sir, the next witness is Mr. Ronald L. Ridenour. Please raise your right hand.
His turned out to be one of the most poignant statements of the 400 hours of taped testimony.
When I was in Vietnam, I looked around me after a while, and I somehow had the feeling as if I'd been the victim of a tremendous fraud, that all the things that we're raised with, all the Boy Scout virtues that every American kid is raised with, as if I was one of the very few, and at times it looked like the only one, who ever believed them, who ever really believed them, what the inalienable rights that are listed. Our Bill of Rights. It appeared to me that in Vietnam, those things existed only for Americans and not for all people.
Ridenour was not the only brave speaker appearing before the Peers Inquiry. 162 members of Task Force Barker testified. The majority had taken part in the massacre, but some courageously had not. One of them was a young Mexican-American GI named Leonard Gonzalez.
That day, it just was a massacre, just plain right out, wiping out people.
It's been suggested that the orders were given so that this little hamlet would just be wiped out as a base for the VC, to level the village.
Wipe it out.
Wipe it out so that nobody could live there anymore and support the VC.
Right, sir.
Did you have the same impression?
When you get the command or the orders saying to wipe everything, kill anything and everything, that's what it is. You're just wiping it right off the map.
It's been suggested by some people that things just got out of control and certain members of the company did all the killing.
No.
Why did it happen?
Well, for revenge. To me, the way we hear it, we figure that the Viet Congs were there with their supporters. Now, when we were sweeping out the area, we didn't find nothing but the civilian people.
Leonard Gonzalez of Charlie Company, who did not fire a single shot that day. Up until the Peers Inquiry, it had been part of the cover-up that only Charlie Company had been involved in the massacre, and only in the village of My Lai. But during the inquiry, it emerged that a second company, Bravo, was also involved and had attacked another village, My Kay. Both companies, it became clear, had received the same briefing before the operation by task force commanders Colonel Orrin Henderson and Lieutenant Colonel Barker. General Pierce and his team concluded that the command to kill was a well-thought-out, concerted plan, not a chaotic free-for-all on the part of rogue soldiers. Most members of Bravo Company refused to testify at the inquiry. Pierce accused them of an almost total cover-up, which is why this testimony from Robert Holmes, a rifleman with Bravo, was so important. He was asked about Bravo's pre-operation briefing. Hooch, as you may remember, are the village houses, and VC are the Viet Cong.
Was there anything discussed about the destruction of villages and the burning of Hooches?
Yes, we were supposed to be a search and destroy mission. And one of the orders that I thought I heard or somebody did say was to shoot anything that moves.
Anything?
Yes, that's the way I received the order. I didn't understand it at the time, really.
Did you receive orders like this before?
No, not in that tone. Just that we understood that Colonel Barker was upset, you know, about the men we've been losing. And, you know, we were led to believe that this area that we were going into was either all VC or they were VC supporters. I thought the area was supposed to be cleared, you know, like the people were supposed to have evacuated the area. But as we found out, there were many, many civilians.
During the course of the inquiry, General Pierce established that 90 civilians had died at the hands of Bravo Company in the village of My Kay on March the 16th, 1968. The main shooting spree was over within little more than 1 hour. But most of the dead were in the village of My Lai.
Steadily toward this road, and there were people
walking along this road.
The day I was there, sat in my little chair and had General Pierce and his group sitting in front of me, and they each asked different questions about the operation, you know, about each photograph and that, and all I did was explain the facts as, you know, I recorded that day. I mean, he was very cordial, never hostile toward me. None of the people on the panel were hostile.
The soldier and photographer Ron Haberle talking today about his testimony to the Pierce inquiry. His photographs provided the panel with crucial evidence. Here's Haberle then describing an iconic photo of My Lai to General Pierce.
I was coming down the trail, and I noticed bringing these people out. And they grabbed, I believe it was this girl behind this woman here, and brought her out front, and they wanted to see what she was more or less made out of. They started, you know, stripping her, taking the top piece off and that. And the mother, that was her mother, was trying to protect her. The GIs were punching around. I remember kicking her in the ass, and I took a photograph of this. Then I sort of turned away, and all of a sudden I heard two M16s open on automatic fire, and I could notice out of the corner of my eye the bodies falling over. To me, that not saying it's poor, just a little bit too much.
During the operation on March the 16th, helicopters had been flying cover for the ground troops. One of the pilots was Hugh Thompson, one of the few heroes of the day. He was returning to the area after refueling and surveyed the damage. He suddenly saw a ditch with bodies in it. He landed. This is what Hugh Thompson told the Pierce inquiry.
When I saw the bodies in the ditch, I came back around and saw that some of them were still alive. So I sat down on the ground then and talked to, pretty sure it was a sergeant, a colored sergeant. And I asked him, I told him that there was, you know, women and kids over there that were wounded. Could he help them, or could they help him? And he made something to the remark, the only way he could help them was to kill them. And I thought he was joking, or didn't take him seriously. And I took off again, and as I took off, my crew chief said that the guy was shooting into the ditch. And as I turned around, I could see a guy holding a weapon pointing towards the ditch.
When he flew back again, Hugh Thompson helped evacuate one survivor left in the ditch, a little boy. As part of the inquiry, General Pierce and a small team traveled to Vietnam. They spent a week there gathering documents and interviewing Vietnamese witnesses. The audio tapes of the Vietnamese testimony weren't released to the BBC, but the interviews conducted with the survivors in the film 4 Hours in My Lai confirmed the inquiry's evidence. Sa Thi Quy was a villager in My Lai. She watched the killings in the ditch.
The people were chased into the ditch like ducks. They fell head first. They were crying, "Oh God, have pity. Please let me up. We are innocent. Have pity." They shot all the people dead. Then silence. Tiny children crawling along the edge of the ditch. It broke your heart. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. I was injured, so I crawled back home.
If the helicopter pilot Hugh Thompson became a hero of the Pierce inquiry and of My Lai, then Colonel Orrin Henderson became the villain. Here he is telling Pierce he'd seen only 6 to 8 civilian dead.
Did you see any bodies in this area?
No, sir, I did not see any civilian dead other than the 6 to 8 that I observed to the south side of My Lai 4.
General Pierce was convinced that Henderson, the overall commander of Task Force Barker, had masterminded the cover-up of the My Lai massacre. He was inexperienced and came over as arrogant. He'd only taken charge of the force the day before the operation, and he'd never seen combat. You can also hear from several testimonies that Henderson had been informed very soon after the massacre about the dead bodies in the ditch. Hugh Thompson himself had gone to see him 2 days after My Lai to make a formal complaint, which Henderson ignored. General Pierce asked Thompson about that conversation with Henderson.
How many bodies did you tell him were in the ditch?
He said about 100, sir. Between 75 and 100. There was a bunch of people there.
How did you feel at this particular time?
Felt like it had been a massacre. I told him something else, you know. He asked me something about how did the bodies get in the ditch. And I told him I didn't know. I said, but I don't think the Americans are going to take a bunch of dead bodies and throw them in a ditch. Or they might even do that, but they're not going to put live bodies in the ditch with the dead ones. And
Vietnamese are not going to all huddle up in the ditch. And that's the part that did not make sense to me, is how the bodies got in the ditch.
When Colonel Henderson was questioned at the inquiry about Hugh Thompson's claims, he denied them. As you can hear, they all use the term non-combatants instead of civilians.
Did Mr. Thompson mention anything to you about landing alongside of a ditch that contained a large number of bodies?
No, sir.
Did he mention to you seeing a colored sergeant point his weapon in the direction of a ditch which contained some dead non-combatants or non-combatants?
No, sir, that he did not report to me any incident of a U.S. soldier firing into a ditch filled with non-combatants or with anybody.
Recalled five times to give evidence, Colonel Henderson continued his denials. He explained to the inquiry that after the My Lai operation was over, he'd intercepted 30 to 40 of the returning soldiers to congratulate them and to quiz them about the event.
So I told them that the reports that I had received led me to believe that they'd done a damn fine job and that I was their new brigade commander and appreciated the fine job that they had done for the brigade. Then I asked them in a group, does anybody here, any individual, any of you, observe any acts against non-combatants, any wild shooting? Did any of you, or did you have knowledge of anybody killing any civilians in this operation? And I got silence. The men had their heads high. There was nobody that was trying to ignore my eyes. I looked at it, had every individual there. They seemed to be in good spirits. They didn't appear to be a bunch of soldiers who had just gone out and shot up the countryside and killed a bunch of women and children.
Did it ever occur to you that psychologically that this was a very poor time and very poor circumstance to be asking individuals if they committed atrocities?
I really didn't stop and think of it, but I have thought of it. I have thought of it since, and I agree it psychologically, yes, it would have been a bad time. And I wouldn't expect a man to stand up and say, yes, I killed a bunch of people.
The investigation into the cover-up is at the heart of the Pierce inquiry. You can hear the exasperation in General Pierce's voice as he questions Colonel Henderson. You can picture Pierce dragging on his enormous cigars, drinking coffee after coffee, having to finish this inquiry by March 1970, before the statute of limitations ran out, 2 years from the date of the crime. The revelations were accumulating. There had been a massacre on an unprecedented scale and an equally massive cover-up. By now in the inquiry, we'd learned that both companies, Bravo and Charlie, had received the same orders from the top to kill. But then we learned that they both, suddenly, received the same orders not to kill from several officers separately. Dennis Bunning was a young conscript in Charlie Company, another of the few who refused to kill on that day. He was in a third village close by, Binh Tay. This is what he told the inquiry.
When we were about halfway through the village, was when we got word over the radio to quit killing people.
Okay, how did you hear about this?
Well, as close as I can remember, you know, I'd come to Lieutenant Brooks over the company net, and then he told us.
Do you remember what his words were?
Well, not exactly, you know. He said something to the effect of that Captain Medina says that's enough shooting now, that we have to quit now. And to me, it didn't make any sense. You know, I couldn't figure out why we had to quit right now, you know, when Medina said we were going to go through, but all I could ever figure out was, well, we figured he got away with as much as he probably thought we were going to get away with or something like this, you know.
The revelations, however, were not over. The Pierce inquiry uncovered the fact there had also been extensive raping on that day, and mainly in the village of Binh Tay. That's where Dennis Bunning had been posted. Most rapes were committed by his platoon of Charlie Company. Bunning bravely spoke out against his own unit.
Now, you've told us yourself, the order was passed to stop the raping.
No, to stop the killing. The raping still went on.
Oh, the raping still went on after the order.
Yeah, and when these guys first started raping a girl, you know, they're just young girls. Some were 15, 16 years old, you know, some down as low as 13 and maybe even 12. I'd go up to a guy, because I'm bigger than him, you know, and I'd grab him and say, you leave that girl alone. I had about five guys come to me, and they says, look, Bunning, everybody goes by last name, says, look, Bunning, you leave us alone and we're going to kill you.
On the basis of this strong testimony from Bunning and from other sources, including Vietnamese sources, General Pierce was able to conclude that there were 18 confirmed rapes in this one hamlet alone, including gang rapes. Phan Thi Sinh witnessed the rape of her sister.
I looked out of the house and saw my sister Mui. She was 14 that year. An American was pressing on top of her. She had no clothing on her. At the time, I didn't understand what that meant. My sister was trying to resist him. Afterwards, the American got up. He put his clothes on. And then he shot her.
General Pierce uncovered irrefutable evidence of rape and murder, and evidence that all the complaints at this time, including from the Vietnamese, had been ignored. The responsibility for this, he concluded, went right to the top of the division. The man whose job it was to handle the complaints of March the 16th was Lieutenant Colonel Charles Anastransky, the AmeriCal Division Civil Affairs Officer. He chose not to pass on the complaints to his division commander, General Samuel Koster. The reason, Pierce believed, was that important promotions were at stake for both men. Here, Anastransky is talking to Pierce at the inquiry.
Do you think there was an attempt to cover this all up within a division to suppress it?
Sir, I don't think the old man would do a thing like General Koster would. He wasn't that type of man.
Suppose he didn't know about it. Did you ever think about that? Did it really ever come to you? To a thought, the fact that maybe, just maybe, that here's a real red-hot piece of information that the commanding general doesn't know about. I mean, is he so sacrosanct that you as a senior staff officer can't go to him?
Oh, we could go to him anytime we wish.
Yes. But did you go to him with this allegation of a war crime being committed?
No, sir, I didn't. I don't know whether it's a war crime or not.
Well, when you see somebody firing and killing any non-combatants, it's a war crime.
Sir, I didn't see anyone firing anything.
You heard it? It was reported to you?
It wasn't reported to me.
Oh,
it's hearsay.
Hearsay or not, by the last few weeks of the inquiry, General Pierce had enough evidence to implicate Colonel Henderson, General Koster, who also testified at the inquiry, and many others. But the scale and horror of the evidence caused many of the witnesses to suddenly clam up, hire their own lawyers, and fear for their own futures. By February 1970, after nearly 2 months, the pressure on General Pierce and his team was intense. He gravely but urgently addressed the inquiry.
We're investigating a situation wherein at the present moment, we can say that we know beyond a doubt that well over 200 Vietnamese and maybe up to 500 of them were killed, and that isn't all of the story. There were numerous rapes that took place. The houses were all destroyed. Six additional sub-hamlets were burned to the ground. All of the animals were destroyed. It's just not the people in Taft Fort Barker that's on trial. In the eyes of the American public, it's the Army. It's you and it's me, and it includes our country. And it includes our people in the eyes of the world.
The inquiry ended on March the 14th, 1970, nearly 2 years to the day after the My Lai massacre. On time. On that day, Pierce presented his findings and recommendations to the heads of the U.S. Army who'd commissioned the inquiry. He produced 4 volumes in total, 20,000 pages and 400 hours of audio recordings. He proposed new methods of training soldiers, guidelines for the treatment of civilians in wartime, new leadership criteria, and several prosecutions. The Pierce lawyer, Jerome Walsh, speaking to the BBC today.
We were shocked on any number of levels by the testimony. First, the killings, and then the level of incompetence up and down the chain of command. And then General Pierce was just terribly shocked by the whole thing. I think you have to remember the focus of our investigation was not the killing, but the failure to report. The fact that something had happened like this, and that all the way up the chain of command, it was just hushed up.
General Pierce and his team were exhausted, but as Jerome Walsh, who'd sat side by side with Pierce for 3 months, explains, they were proud of their work.
I think the real impact of our work was on the Army itself. And by that I mean the fact that the Army did this and tried to bring these people to justice. The fact that the effort was made did survive, that it survived in the Army War College and in the Command and General Staff School, where I was told by any number of people was something that was taught to the higher-ups in the Army as their education progressed. And here, the Army War College, the same thing. It had led then to field manual writing, which spelled out the training that must be given to soldiers about war crimes. It is still part of the history and of the genes of the United States Army today. And it's been interesting to me that in the disputes over the Guantanamo base and the interrogation of prisoners there, etc., it has been the Army against the White House that has been the dispute and flashpoint, because the Army lawyers, going back to the My Lai, they know what should be done, and it doesn't include torturing prisoners.
If the report findings made an impact on the U.S. Army, in the way it trained soldiers for one, its shocking revelations were watered down for public consumption. In his final press conference on March the 17th, 1970, General Pierce had drafted a statement for the media and used the term massacre. But the Pentagon objected to this wording. It might harm the Army's image. So Pierce used the phrase, a tragedy of major proportions.
I can say, however, and I feel that the public is entitled to know, that our inquiry clearly established that a tragedy of major proportions occurred there on that date.
General Pierce had hoped for top-down prosecutions. He had concluded that 30 senior officers had been negligent in their duty. After the inquiry, 14 officers were charged with crimes. But the only participant convicted of anything at My Lai was Lieutenant William Calley. Colonel Henderson was court-martialed, accused of covering up evidence of the massacre and making false statements. He was acquitted. General Pierce had, in effect, been gagged. He died of a heart attack in 1984, so Jerome Walsh tells us of Pierce's reaction at the time.
He was disappointed. He was behind, very much behind, and enthusiastically behind the bringing of charges against these people who had failed to report these things. I mean, the results were, of course, a fiasco for military justice in that Calley was the only one convicted. He was convicted of murder by a court-martial of his peers. Well, the message of this, for sheer political advantage, this was really disgusting because it ruined the chances of convicting the others, and it was just a fiasco.
Good evening, everyone. Less than a half hour ago, the Republic of South Vietnam unconditionally surrendered to the Viet Cong. President Dong Van...
The Vietnam War ended in 1975, but it has left far-reaching scars. The psychological trauma for the My Lai victims and perpetrators has continued.
It's why I'm old before my time. I remember it all the time. I'm all alone and life is hard. Thinking about it has made me old. I won't forgive. I hate them very much. I won't forgive as long as I live.
How can you forgive? You know, I can't forgive myself for the things. Even though I know it was something that I did and something that I was told to do, but how can I forgive that? I forgive. I can't. I live with it every day.
A Vietnamese villager from My Lai, and Bernardo Simpson, the former GI with Charlie Company, who you heard earlier in the program admitting killing at least 25 people. His role in the massacre destroyed his life. He consumed fistfuls of medication every day. He made 3 attempts at suicide and indeed succeeded in 1997. Fred Widmer, also of Charlie Company, tells us today how My Lai changed his life.
Shortly after my return back to the States, I started drinking and got into drugs. You might say for about 5 years I went on a little bit of a bender. I was an alcoholic druggie. After a period of time, you kind of wake up and say, this is not the way things should be. I finally started to get my act together. I have psychological scars I'll carry with me to the grave. You can't erase what happened and things you did. You can't go back and rectify a past situation.
Vietnam veterans and people who came back from the My Lai experience did suffer, had many symptoms. We began to develop the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it became incorporated into American psychiatric thought.
Dr. Robert Lifton is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Now over 80, he developed his renowned study of the relationship between historical events and individual psychology during the Vietnam War by interviewing those who took part.
My Lai was a product of what I call an atrocity-producing situation. That is, a situation, an environment, so constructed militarily and psychologically that an ordinary person, no better or worse than you or me, is capable of committing atrocities. It makes it understandable to a degree only psychologically. It does not make it forgivable, and it doesn't forgive anyone in relation to it. The people remain responsible for what they did.
Today, the killings by soldiers of Iraqi civilians in Haditha and the abuse of prisoners in Abu Ghraib remind us of the responsibility soldiers bear for their actions in wartime and their treatment of civilians. Dr. Robert Lifton has made comparisons with Iraq and Vietnam, the focus of his new research into military activity and individual behavior.
Vietnam still haunts us, and it haunts our behavior in Iraq. What happened at My Lai was extremely indicative of the American problem in Vietnam at that time, and I would say the American problem in Iraq right now. Of course, the two wars are very different wars, but what they have in common is also striking. An American war of unclear purposes in a far-off place with a non-white population, which is a counterinsurgency war in which it becomes difficult or impossible to distinguish combatants from civilians, with the additional element of an occupation in Iraq and all the perils and psychological contradictions of such an occupation. And we've had a series of atrocities in Iraq, though they've been smaller ones. Nonetheless, there is this everyday struggle with the possibility of atrocity, in which, again, the men and women fighting in Iraq become both victims and executioners.
Most Americans, if they know anything about My Lai, know that some soldiers killed some civilians. But they have little grasp of the scale of the massacre. People may have heard of Lieutenant Kelly, but what about Mi Kay, Bin Tay, Henderson, and Anna Stransky? A simpler, sanitized My Lai massacre has become the accepted version of events. 40 years on, the lessons that were learned from the Piers inquiry have been largely forgotten. It's almost as if it never happened. But the problem with cover-ups is they set the stage for further abuses. Today, the public has difficulty believing its troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are capable of atrocities because they don't understand that they've happened before. Men like Hugh Thompson, Ron Haberle, Leonard Gonzalez, Ronald Ridenour, Dennis Bunning, and General Piers, whose stories you've heard in this program, are heroes we should be proud of, but we've marginalized them. The men at My Lai still alive today deal with the massacre in their own ways. Ron Haberle continues to photograph, but for his own pleasure. He was unable to take any war photos after that fateful day.
It is true. I really didn't take a photograph for a while, but I did start picking up again and taking out my camera and just started doing stuff for my own pleasure. Just started recording my travels. 2001, I did a bike trip from Hanoi to Saigon, and we did stop at the village of My Lai. It's not the same as it was because, the area is very much, built up and that. They do have a museum there. When I was really surprised when I walked into the museum, there's all these photographs. These are all my photos, almost like my own little museum there. And after looking at the photographs, I went out and started walking around the area, and they have the monument there, and they have who was killed at what point, and they also have the ditch. But on the wall, which is kind of was amazing to me, was the name of every person engraved in the wall. I felt, I finally realized this is what happened to tragedy did happen, and there was way too many non-combatants killed that day. These photographs that I've taken are a part of history. I hope people learn from this that this does happen in war. And the sad part about war is that the civilians are the ones that suffer.
Fred Widmer, a soldier in My Lai on March the 16th, 1968, today visits schools and colleges in the U.S., determined that it will not be forgotten.
In a way, I feel it is my duty to talk about Vietnam and the My Lai incident, because today I feel that it has had a greater impact than it had way back in the beginning. The fact that I do get involved with students, talking to them, you try to bring out some good out of a bad situation. And whatever good that you can pass on to these students to help them in their later life, if you can reach one or two students, you've done something good.
Bye.